How will the broadcast from Artemis be different from Apollo? Can planetary systems survive their stars exploding? Can a completely different life hide deep inside the Earth? And in Q&A Plus, when should we expect the new NIAC Awards? All in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down, gather them up, and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. ABC Boat 2XY. Realistically, based on your experience and knowledge, when do you think we will get humans back to the moon? So, I mean, at the time that we're recording this, at the time that you're watching this, the Artemis 2 mission is either going to launch almost tomorrow, or we'll have to wait because it's scrubbed a bunch of times and we'll have to wait another month. But we're going to have humans get on top of the Space Launch System and they're going to fly around the moon. So soon, but obviously I think what you're looking at is, you know, when will humans set foot on the surface of the moon? And that is going to take a little longer. Right now, the Artemis 3 mission is scheduled for probably 2027, 2028. But even then, there's a bunch of issues with the lander. You know, we haven't seen Starship do a bunch of the things that are required to demonstrate that it can be the lander for the Artemis 3 mission. Maybe they'll sort those out, but if they don't, Blue Origin has its version of a lunar lander. So someone will figure that out probably by 2030. And at the same time, the Chinese are planning to send humans to the moon by 2030. And so far, they've hit all of their milestones. All of the missions leading up to their human missions to the moon, all of the Chang'e missions, their Mars missions, sample return missions, these have all come together. So it would not surprise me if they just hit their timeline. You know, their space station, their servicing to and from the space station, this is all happening. So it really feels like 2030 is the date when this will probably happen, that NASA may have a few more delays, but be really trying to race to get everything to beat the Chinese back to the moon. The Chinese are going to follow their schedule, and I think you'll see someone set foot on the moon in 2030 at the latest and maybe the earliest. Arjun, how should the streaming of astronauts during the new moon landing be different from what we landed in the 60s? What cool things should they do now that weren't possible then? I mean, it is pretty amazing that humanity was able to watch the Apollo moon landing live when it happened. I mean, think about the engineering. And there's this great video drama about what it took to be able to get the radio telescope in Australia aligned so it was able to broadcast the Apollo landings while it was happening. It was before my time, but you know, my dad remembers it fondly, and I'm sure people who are watching this right now fondly remember being in school and them putting that on the television. And you're watching a person set foot on the moon for the first time in human history, and it happened live. So obviously we have a revolution in technology at this point. We have miniature cameras, we have high definition broadcast. The technology is totally different at this point. And yet, you still have the challenge that being at the moon is much, much farther away. And so you're kind of limited by how much you can like live broadcast back to the Earth. You know, if you're hoping that you could try to send 4K, it'd be really tricky to get that kind of throughput from the moon back to Earth in a way that it could then be broadcast live. Now, obviously, there'll be hard drives, they'll be able to store the information, they'll be able to bring it back, and then they'll be able to display it. If we got even like high def would be amazing for all the live stuff that was happening. You know, I think we've become really spoiled from SpaceX because they put all these cameras on their spacecraft. And we get a chance to see drones. While Starship is lifting off, we see the view from the different fins on the spacecraft. We see the landing drone where the rockets are coming and landing down in the ocean. And so that's the level that we would love to be able to see during these upcoming human moon missions, whether it's from the Americans or from the Chinese. You know, we'll get some kind of live broadcast for Artemis 3, I'm sure, but it won't be the kind of multi-camera setups that we would all love to be able to see, just because still the bandwidth going to and from the moon is limited. So, but yeah, I can't wait. Arjun, maybe we could use lasers like they did to transmit the image of the cat. Yeah, I mean, so the Psyche mission has demonstrated that you can use lasers as a way to communicate very rapidly from deep space, you know, tens of millions of kilometers away. You're able to transmit it at broadband levels. And so hopefully they will have some kind of laser transmitter on board that they'll be able to communicate back to Earth and send tons and tons of data back. I hope so. That'd be great. We didn't see that in Artemis 1. I'll be watching for something like that in Artemis 2. It would be a good time to test that kind of technology, but I haven't heard anything about it. Murray von Kerman, can a planetary system survive the supernova star, and what happens to the planets if they survive? I mean, you have to describe what you mean by survive. You know, we know that if a star goes supernova within about 25 light years of us, it's a very bad day for the Earth. The radiation from the supernova will strip away chunks of our ozone layer, will increase the amount of radiation down on the surface of the Earth. If it's even closer, you know, 5, 6, 8 light years away, it'll start to just like tear away at the atmosphere itself. Imagine what it would be like if you were in that system. It would be very, very bad. Like, will your planet get vaporized? Maybe, but you're definitely not going to come back from that. And then the star will be gone. So you will be left with either a neutron star, which does radiate, but not very well, or a black hole, which doesn't radiate at all. So no matter what happens, the planets will probably be gone in the explosion. And if they even do survive, then the remnant that is left behind is of no use for life on those worlds. It's time to shout out all the new $5 patrons and above. Rajiv Achari, Tom Simonson, Richie Rich 61, Tom Gabalian, Arno de Groot, Martin Robinson, Europa, William Andrews, Meg, and Lee McKay. Join the club at patreon.com/universe today. Lubo in China. What is your favorite telescope? So I've got a bunch of telescopes now. This is space nerd problem, which is that I've been getting a bunch of demo units. So I now have 5 telescopes, which is a lot. So I have the Dobsonian, the 8-inch Dobsonian that I bought with my own money. I have the C-Star S50, which I bought with my own money. And then I have the Vespera from Veonis, which was sent to me as a demo unit. And then I have a, I don't know if you can see it, but I have an 80 millimeter refractor up there. And then I just got a dwarf mini sent to me as a demo. And this is really cool. I've only had a chance to like take one picture before the cloud sucked in, and then that was that. So I'm looking forward to another clear spot. You can tell we've got clouds because all the telescopes are back here in the studio with me. So what is my favorite telescope? Well, my favorite telescope is the telescope that I had when I was 13 years old. I had a 4-inch Newtonian reflector that I bought from a company in Vancouver, and it was on an alt azimuth mount. So it wasn't on a equatorial mount. If you want to look at something, you had to be able to get good at zigzagging with it. I had bought it because there was like a garage sale where I grew up, and someone was giving away literally hundreds of astronomy magazines and sky and telescope magazines. And so I had all of these magazines sitting in my room, and I would just go through them page after page, reading the stories, looking at what was up. And they were from 10, you know, in some cases fairly new, others cases 15, 20 years back. And then they all had these ads for telescopes. And so I really got to know the different kinds of telescopes that were out there. And then I was decided I'm buying a telescope. And then I did a lot of research, and I found a company in Vancouver that was relatively close to me. And I bought the telescope, and I think I picked it up, brought it back home and set it up. It blew my mind. Like, I saw Saturn through a telescope for the first time. I saw Jupiter. I saw Mars. I saw the ice caps on Mars. I saw the bands across the planet on Jupiter. And then I began to learn the night sky, learn the constellations. And it was incredible. I still now today, I walk outside, the constellations in the sky are this map that I understand, that I learned when I was 14 years old. And it's never gone. It's never left me. So like, if you haven't learned your constellations, learn your constellations. You know, a pair of binoculars are the best way to do this. You can see a lot of this, the bright stuff in the constellations right now. Andromeda, Galaxy, Orion Nebula, various clusters, the globular cluster in Hercules. You can see the planets. Binoculars are great. But yeah, so that was my favorite telescope. And this is so much of a better telescope, right? Like an 8-inch Dobsonian beats a 4-inch Newtonian, hands down. Even an 80-millimeter refractor beats it. But, you know, in my mind, when I look back and I think about what it was like to look at Saturn, look at Jupiter through that telescope, it's better than this, which it's not, but it feels like it was. So it's in my nostalgia telescope is my favorite telescope. Of the group that I have right now, I would say my favorite is my astronomical binoculars. So the binoculars are number one. And then I would say it's the Dob and the C-Star are sort of one and two. And they flip back and forth. Like if I want to look at something visually, you go with the Dob. If I want to take a picture, you use the C-Star. But yeah, the nostalgoscope is my favorite. Jasper Rust. Is it possible that a form of life completely unrelated to known Earth life could exist deep underground? I mean, theoretically, yes, but the chance of it being completely unrelated to life on Earth is pretty low. There are some who think that the bulk of the life on Earth is actually underground, that we have extremophile bacteria that can handle temperatures of up to like 130 Celsius. And so if you do the math, life is probably sustainable all the way down to about 6 kilometers deep underground, at which point temperatures get to about 150 Celsius. And then below that, just nothing can survive. But there's water mixed in with the rock down to those depths. And when you sort of consider the surface of the Earth, you consider this shell of the Earth 6 kilometers deep, that's a lot of room for life compared to what's on the surface. But water gets from underground to the surface, from the surface to underground. And so we're connected to all of this life that's underground. The idea that I like that's kind of similar is this idea of shadow life. All life on Earth shares a common ancestor. You know, at some point, 4.1 billion years ago, something went from some combination of hydrocarbons and basic sugars and alcohols and electricity and other chemicals, and who knows how it worked. We went to something that could be the first life form, something that was self-replicating, where Darwinian evolution could take over and then it could evolve into the other kinds of forms of life that we have. Every single life form that has ever been found on all of planet Earth can be traced back to that same ancestor. But maybe, you know, if you had one abiogenesis, you had one thing that went from non-life to life, maybe that's happened multiple times. Now, if it has happened multiple times, then maybe all of the times it just got eaten by something, you know, more well established. You know, if you've got a little blob of chemicals turn into something that's like maybe a little bit viable, and then a dinosaur walks along and slurps it up, and that's that, right? But what if some other kind of life formed and it is incompatible with life as we know it? And so life on Earth wouldn't perceive it as food. And it would, in fact, the kinds of tools that we use to perceive life in general are really reliant on the kinds of chemicals, the kinds of processes that, you know, DNA, RNA based life goes through. And so there could be an entire shadow ecosystem here on the Earth that has been with us forever, doing its own thing, that we have just never known. Now, it has to be bacteria sized in nature. Like if there were shadow trees, I think we would spot them. Shadow dogs, right? But bacteria deep underground that uses its own chemistry, its own sources of fuel, completely unrelated from the life that we have, it would actually be really hard for us to find out. And so this is an idea that biologists consider is shadow life. And so, you know, people talk about this idea of like making life mirror life, right? And so you just like take the chirality of DNA and you flip it around and it's probably viable and probably very dangerous. But that's like the kind of thing, but even like more exotic than that. We could have aliens here on Earth, but they're not really aliens because they evolved here on our planet as well. And they have as much right to this planet as we do. Cortos, are there any NIAC programs that have made progress since your last round of interviews? It's about time for the next announced group of NIAC awards. So generally what happens is they give out about 12 round one NIAC awards at the beginning of the year. And then they give out maybe four to six round two awards partway through the year. And then they'll give out the occasional round three award, and they kind of happen randomly. We're going to have to wait. We're going to see an entirely new crop of NIAC awards, probably within a couple of months. And then later on towards the summer, we'll see that round two where we find the ones, the earlier ones that have been funded even deeper. So I haven't heard anything new, you know, I promise you. The moment there are more NIAC awards, I reach out to every single researcher and say, can I interview you, please? And I get most of them. So that's awesome. All right. Those are all the questions that we had this episode. Thank you, everyone who asked your questions into the YouTube comments. Everybody who joined me for the live show, which, of course, we're now leaving the live show up here. But of course, there's the next one coming up on the next Monday. So you can check that out. If you're watching this before the end of the week, it's going to be live on Monday, February 9th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. So hopefully we'll see you there for the live stream. But now you don't have to worry. You'll be able to watch it afterwards. I'm going to bring you up to speed on some new media that I have been consuming. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrea Pedretti, Bear Lake Roofing, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Dark Finga, David Giltonan, David Matz, Evan.pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Switz, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Parlbuck, Renkaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Valley Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Wolfgang Klotz, and Zeldabor Galactic Defender, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I've been consuming some media recently I thought I would bring you up to speed on. So the first thing is I'm reading a book. The latest book I'm reading, The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. And I got inspired because I was watching Pluribus, which I love. And the main character is reading The Left Hand of Darkness. And that reminded me that I really want to read The Left Hand of Darkness. So I finally did. It's a terrific book. It's just a great book. It's not what you expect. It's a great telling of a very bizarre society that kind of logically makes a ton of sense and sort of the perspective of an outsider who is attempting to bring them into a sort of the federation of planets and having to deal with their machinations and their politics and their scheming. And part of it is the sort of the politics, and then part of it is this sort of adventure story where they're running from the law, and it's just a terrific book. So if you've been meaning to read it, I can wholeheartedly endorse and agree that Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin is a terrific book. On the TV front, we've been watching a bunch of new media. So the first thing is we're just wrapping up the new season of Fallout, and so far it's been great. And for me, because it's set in New Vegas and has all of these characters from New Vegas, which is the best Fallout, it's just great. And just the Easter eggs are coming so fast and furious that I can barely keep up. And I'm really, really enjoying that. So if you haven't already, you can watch the second season of Fallout. And the next show kind of came out of nowhere for me, and that's Wonder Man on Disney Plus. And this is part of the Marvel Universe. And I was like vaguely familiar with Wonder Man as a character in the Marvel Universe, but this show kind of has nothing to do with the original Wonder Man, except for maybe the name of the lead. And it is not what you expect. There's very little superheroing in this television show. It feels to me like the closest example is like if there was a Marvel version of Atlanta. So it's weird, surreal stories, strange things are happening, and yet it's actually very well done. And it's kind of it's an insight into anxiety and rage and Hollywood. And it's very, very good. And I definitely recommend it. I think it's my favorite Marvel thing that I've seen in quite a while. And then the last show, which I don't know how this ends yet, but we're watching A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which is sort of in the Game of Thrones averse. And this is based on a short story from George R.R. Martin that they turned into a show. And we're starting to now figure out who the various major characters are in this show. And just the sort of the world building and the quality of the show is quite amazing. It's about a knight who's planning to participate in a tournament, and just the whole time is spent as he's preparing for this tournament and hanging around with all these people and all of the infighting and political machinations. And he's ill-equipped to be able to do this, but really wants to be able to participate in the tournament. And just the attention to detail of all of the characters and the costumes and the food and the clothing and the armor and the pots. It's so great, and I'm really enjoying it so far. They're all fairly short episodes, very snackable, and yet it's actually a really good show. So check that out, Fallout, Wonder Man, and A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. All right, we'll see you next time.